You have this presentation from Daniel Stockel from EPHE and Haim Lapin from University of Maryland. And just after, you will have, so we shall have a small discussion. And after, we shall have a presentation of the Obville LabX by Glenn Rowe and Didier Alexandre. And then after, we shall have 1 hour discussion. So maybe you can go back to the point which were not discussed enough for the first talk, because the last discussion is for all the different talk. Okay? So, you can start. So this is a presentation about, and I'm very interesting in this, and I have no idea, a model digital edition of the Mishnah. And so, thank you very much.
So, I'm jet lagging, so I'm not sure if I'm supposed to say good morning or good afternoon, but good morning, and thank you for having this project as part of this presentation. I want to start by saying that the transatlantic grant actually facilitated our collaboration. We've been emailing back and forth. This is my idea about what I'm doing. This is my idea about what I'm doing. And it's really the grant that allowed us to have to actually put together a project that merged two overlapping things, and it's actually been incredibly productive. So I just want to say thank you both to the FMSH and to the Mellon Foundation for facilitating that. So let me just start by setting the ground, because I assume that a small number of people in the room knows or cares about the Mishnah. So let me talk, first of all, just a little bit of background and why it's an interesting project. So first of all, the text is from about the year 200, and in what emerges as Judaism in late antiquity and survives in every form of Judaism to the present, it is a foundational text. It's hard to say the words I'm about to say, but you know, equal in importance in its own way to the Bible, right? It's studied, it's memorized. School kids have competitions in how much of it they can memorize, right? So it's still an object of both traditional scholarly study and modern scholarly study. So it's enormously important. It also sits at the root of a vast literature of a Talmudic literature that continues till today, but certainly in terms of its classical form, runs through antiquity and into the Middle Ages. What makes it an interesting project for the kinds of things that we're interested in is that it is part of a citational network, right? It's multilingual. Certainly the Mishnah has a little bit of Aramaic, but it's using two dialects of Hebrew, because it's referring to biblical material as well, and then repurposing biblical words in new ways. It's a work that's formed out of existing traditions, right? Existing materials, and part of the work of the literary criticism or the historical criticism of the Mishnah and other rabbinic texts is about source work. It's got strong overlaps with a wider penumbra of literature that's more or less contemporary, so it's an interesting text reuse example. And then starting with two Talmuds and then running to last Thursday, a vast commentary literature. So it forms, for the kinds of purposes that we're interested in, it forms a vast, it's part of a vast referential and citational literature, and it's also important in its own right as a historical document. Did I move? It's an important cultural heritage document. It's important as a historical document in its own right, in the sense that it raises issues of provinciality and Romanization in the Roman world. It's an early and very, very extensive example of a vernacular literature, certainly before the emergence of Syriac and Coptic as large literatures. And And so it's important both for the history of Roman provincial history, social history, things like that, and also for the history of Judaism. And then finally, it's an interesting issue. It has presents interesting issues of text preservation and transmission, because as far as we can tell, the text is known, the text exists in, let's say, the early 3rd century. It's hard to give it a firm date. But none of the manuscripts predate the 10th century. Some may be in the 10th century, but they're more likely to be 11th, 12th, 13th centuries. So we have this vast gap, right, between the initial composition that some scholars want to argue was absolutely, completely, and unrelievedly oral, right, and the committing to print. But by the time we get the text, it already has significant in written form. It has significant rubrics and literary forms and lines of transmission. So it forms an interesting set of questions in that respect as well. Let me turn it over to Daniel, who will actually talk about the edition that we've been working on in this context.
So I'll try to present the web application that we built and during the project. I'll switch to the actual application, trying to do the risky live presentation, also because this is a little small, but also because what we did here is, I think, nice. Chaim will say much more about what is behind it, but it's entirely in XML, and it's so generic that you should be able to take it and put your own text into it. But Chaim will expose that much more. It is built here. This is the entry window where you can see the transcription and the translation. You can switch to a French translation. You can switch the transcription from the current view, which is aligned to the manuscript layout, to more a document structure layout here that corresponds to the actual canonical structure of the composition. It is usually indicating what is parallel, so that you can easily navigate, and it's panelized so that you can, for example, add a facsimile of the manuscript that would also indicate which line we are talking about. It's probably very small up there, so I'll delete that. You can zoom, obviously, you can zoom in here, and it would go wherever you need to move. You can browse according to the organization of the manuscript, structure of the manuscript, which is, as Chaim said, about as large as the Bible, not only as important as it, and you can also browse according to the canonical text structure. So we have these two overlapping hierarchies. Like you can go here to here we go. And now we can let's put this back to the manuscript layout, make it a little smaller so one can see this better on this screen resolution, which is obviously low because it's linked to the PowerPoint. You can add a linguistic panel to get linguistic information about words. Wait a second, not pulling, just a second, that is the live demonstration. Let's go. Will it pull it? Wait a second. We will move. Here we go. So you can have, there's a dictionary behind it, there's a morphological analysis behind it. We will talk about this more in the end. You can see lots of other manuscripts. The connection is not very fast here. Come on. Here we go. So there, this is just one manuscript, but as you can see, there are lots and lots and lots and lots of other manuscripts. And an important part of it is the text critical work. Obviously, when you have a text with lots of different manuscripts, so there's automatic textual comparison behind it. You can choose the witnesses you would like to visualize. And then you can get them either as a table, like this. This is Hebrew to most of you, I assume. But you can see that they are aligned, and the color evaluation gives you some information about what is similar and what is unsimilar. And you can also get this into an apparatus view. We need the check it all button.
Well, we also need persistence between views. There are a lot of features in the web application that aren't quite working the way they're supposed to yet, but I think that's the nature of web applications.
No? Does it come? Right, that I know works very well. I can show it on the PowerPoint. It usually works very well. I don't know whether this is the connection. Now it's stuck completely. Just a second. Well, you can, in theory, you can reorder the witnesses according to the importance, but this should really work. Let's. Here we go. Okay, so you would have the text, the main text, and then a regular critical apparatus view as you have in a critical edition, classical critical edition, with the different lemmas. And then obviously you can download those texts. They are in TI-XML. And is there anything I missed? Well, you have a search function here. You can set the website in a different language. This is where we currently are. So here's the stable version that reacts immediately, regardless of connection speed. You can obviously visualize the manuscript in a full window, and there's IIIF behind this. And is there anything I forgot? And you can edit the variants in an application Chaim has built. Obviously, we're using CollateX in the background, and obviously sometimes there's a misaligned word, so you can actually correct the computer where you need to correct it. There are a couple of features in development. So one is that we want to have the IIIF extension on a word level, not only on a line level. We'll explain that in a second with regard to the automatic manuscript HDR we're doing. We have parameterized linguistic searches under development so that you can actually look for a noun before a verb in the past tense and followed by something which has a preposition, and automatic systematics.
Okay. So so that's the way the application basically works. And what I'm what I'd like, what we're going to talk about now is the data model and structure, as well as some of the features we'd like to develop in the way that it interacts with other projects. So in terms of the data model, we had a number of principles, right? The principles were that it should be generic, it should be interoperable, and it should be extensible, right? Neither of us are computer scientists by training. I certainly am not by inclination. So some of these concepts are a little hard to figure out. But first of all, we wanted to start with the idea of works and witnesses. And I would define works as more or less coherent bodies of text that get transmitted as such, sometimes, as with Robinson Crusoe in the 18th century, in the 19th century, lots of variation, but still recognizable as variations of the same thing. Witnesses are the concrete instantiations of those works. So in our context, the Mishnah is a work. Any given manuscript or print or digital edition is a witness. Our witnesses have, just for the simple fact that they are what they are, a dual structure, right? There's the for printed or written manuscripts, there's the document structure. And in theory, every single one of these is unique, right? With the printing press, there's still the question of use history, and did someone write an inscription on it, and did somebody's kid write, you know, draw something on it? But certainly with manuscripts, every single one of them is going to be unique. So we want to retain the metadata about use and provenance and all those other kinds of issues. And we want to make sure that what we're doing is recording within the document itself the various features that are important to reconstruct the document. Generically, page, line, rubrication, all sorts of choir marks, those kinds of things. And then there's the text structure, which in our case follows a canonical structure, which makes it easy to grab for comparison of texts, easy to grab a chunk of text by an identifier of that canonical chunk at whatever level of granularity. We have a system of IDs that follows the canonical structure and goes down to the word, and in theory at least the character or glyph level, right, by offset from the word. And one of the reasons we use the canonical structure is that means that if we realize that at some point 6 months into development we've forgotten a manuscript sheet, right, what page in the manuscript, we don't have to redo all the IDs for the entire manuscript. There's a canonical, we have smaller chunks that need to be updated, and then we can actually do stuff both at the IIIF text image alignment, but also in the morphology of grabbing individual characters or combinations of characters or glyphs for smaller and finer grained analysis. The work is, in this context, made up of witnesses. In theory, the work, I mean, in practice, work is represented by a table, right, of alignments. I recognize that it could be represented by a graph, and one of the things I'm really interested in doing is thinking about all of these projects that Daniel and I are working on is as sort of creating this network of intersecting graphs, and I'm not quite sure how. I don't have either the computer skills or the conceptual depth to actually make that work, but that's one of the things I'm thinking about. And in theory, they should incorporate, just by the structure of the data, links, ways of linking out to the physical features of the witness or grammatical forms or loci on a surface in a manuscript and so on. And then works combine with other works to form corpora or libraries, and that's where the text reuse or text overlap problem comes into play. Practically, at a practical implementation level, and this is all still stuff in development, but you can see part of it in our application, when we actually have lexical data, we don't actually want a morphological analysis for each word for each token as it appears in each witness, we want to be able to have aggregated tables and loci that can be pointed to, rather than having several zillion one-to-one links, but actually conglomerate them using the either the tabular structure or the graph structure. And once we move into the text reuse context, it becomes important for linking not the text as it appears in one standardized form to the text as it appears in another standardized form, but it being able to link one range of text with all its variation to another range of text with all its variation. So going back to our basic idea of generic, interoperable, and extensible, we have tried as much as possible to work with existing or more or less generic standards of input and output. So we're TEI compliant in our texts. We're using, at least sometimes, most of the time, sometimes we realize, I realized I was guilty of tag abuse recently, so I confess, here in public and undertake penance. When we do the morphological markup, we're aiming at matching it with a relatively recent ISO standard for morphological annotation. And when we develop new tools, they're supposed to work with these standards or to be themselves generic and to work for more than a single use case. So the other thing that we want to do in terms of interoperability is to the fact that we're using IDs, hard IDs for down to the word level, virtual IDs down to the character glyph level, makes it possible to embed this in a universe of linked open data. We've experimented with presenting the texts through the canonical text service that the Perseus project has done. I mean, it works. The question is whether that's the best way to go forward. And we've, as part of that, we're also investigating repositories of standardized named entities for personal names, place names, and things like that. And everything we've developed, we can imagine being used for all the other texts that we are interested in working on as part of the larger penumbra of projects. But there's nothing specific to Hebrew, Aramaic, right to left, or antiquity that's in any of these things, that it all is, at least by design, right, and by intention, applicable to other corpora. One last thing we need to do, the other piece that's meant to be generic is that we've made use of the good services of Exist Solutions, who developed the Exist database, who created a tool called TEI Publisher, which we simply have to make a shout out to because they've been extraordinarily helpful and used our project as an opportunity to develop some new features as part of the publisher, like the panelization, right? The ability to have one, two, three forms that each are independent of one another. It began as a project of the TEI, but and using the schema document that TEI calls odd, but really using it as a way for people to build reasonably complex additions with built-in search features and built-in presentation features by specifying what you want the typical behavior of a certain element to be. Right? Once you need it to do certain kinds of complex things, then it needs the programming, but it needs a developer. Right? But the nice thing was that you immediately step into a structure that works and that should work with any properly encoded text. Right? And so it's both part of the underlying works of our document, but also something that we need to acknowledge as part of our as part of this project.
So it is free. You can just go there to the TEI publisher site. You can configure your own website. You can configure whether you want this to be red or you can to be green or this tag or this tag. And our contribution was especially to add the possibility to have these panels, which most critical editions use in some sense. So it is a call to the wider public to develop projects in this way, to develop a common tool that can be used by other projects, like this TI publisher tool, which is really quite proficient now, and add another feature that then could be incorporated by other projects. We will now go to the more computational side of what we have done. And you see here one of our manuscripts, a manuscript from Cambridge, where we had a fantastic print transcription from the late 19th century, but no open text. So we tried to OCR the transcription with regular commercial programs, and it works somehow nice, but you don't get all. I mean, if you see here, I don't know whether it's big enough, but there are a lot of small features in the transcription that really identically represent semantic values that are in the type of layout of the manuscript. So, for example, ligatures are represented by ligatures for the divine name, or the versification of the manuscript has a different font as it has a different script in the manuscript. Or if there are elevated characters at the end of a line, they are elevated also in the transcription. We wanted to keep all the semantics. No commercial OCR program would do that. So if you see here, one of the problems or the reasons was also that what you see in the bottom side here is all the same letter. Okay, but the book has simply too many fonts. There are 7 or 8 different fonts, font sizes for the same letter. And so what we did is writing our own OCR program to retain all the semantic information, working with a very simple clustering approach and connected components. And we got a very, very good result that we could then transform to Microsoft Word. I mean, it's more than 99%, 99.5% correct, according to what we manually evaluated, and keep all the semantic information that was in the original transcription. We found lines that were missed in the very good transcription when we then aligned our transcription of the transcription to the original manuscript. So we could also improve on that. And this can then be transformed, or has been transformed, to XMLTI, and the result you can now see on the website or in some other visualization. Starting from that, which was print OCR, we developed forms dealing with manuscripts themselves. My school, the UPSR, is extremely interested in paleography, and where we want to go is to the world of astronomers, being able to, like them, compare not only galaxies, let's say a script from the 17th century to a script from the 18th century, but also go back to every single star and constellation. So to have the link from the global vision to the very single data point. And their manuscript HTR obviously gives you the entry. So what we developed is on the basis of something that has been, that is open source and is existing Ocropus. Ocropus has not a very good layout analysis. So that is where we wrote some relatively simple code that simply works very well for manuscripts that have a regular layout. I mean, you have in manuscripts this kind of marginal additions that are noisy, but we work with something that is called, that we call Z profile, that takes the regularity of the manuscript into consideration. So this images below is just as if you were looking on the manuscript from the top to the bottom with X-rays. And then all the things that are not repeated on every page obviously vanish. And you can segment the manuscript layout relatively easily. We developed an existing algorithm called SeamCarve, so that it corresponds much better to regular manuscript layouts. So on the left side, you say the state, what would be done before, and on the right side, we added the heartbeat SeamCarve, we call it, that would take the regularity into account, and even if the lines are very short and the profile would not be, and the horizontal profile would not give a huge mountain, so it would be missed. Here, there's a line missing, a red line missing, so these two lines would be recognized as one single line with the regular SeamCarve. Ours has no problem dealing with this kind of stuff, and here you see that for the manuscript we showed in the beginning, we can come up to something like 3% error ratio with the current application on sometimes 2, sometimes slightly below 2 of the main consonantal text. And if one goes into what kind of errors there are, most of the errors indicated here in red are where the letters are higher, or even for the human eye, it's difficult to see whether there is a space here. If I ask you whether there's a space here or here, those who don't need read Hebrew, they say maybe. That's just as the computer says, the maybe, because there's no language model behind it yet. The typical errors you can see here are the confusions that also human scribes do all the time between letters that are looking the same, Resh and Dalet, Kaf and Bet, or a space, not a space. Then Chaim and I wrote an application for Microsoft Word that enables us to visualize the manuscript lines with two transcriptions and visualize the differences between them in a color code, which is very, very practical and renders the process for correcting the automatic transcription relatively smooth. This has led to a couple of follow-up projects. So two projects. One is starting right now, called Sofer Mahir, meaning the tachygraph, the scribe who's very fast for automatic transcription of the most important manuscripts of the Tanaitic literature, so about 12 large manuscripts. Tikkun Sofrim, which will apply crowdsourcing and on that gamification and machine learning in order to understand the crowd behavior that is currently undergoing with the University of Haifa. And in the Scripta PSL project, what we are doing is combining these AI applications together with the hardcore, very traditional paleography, where one can annotate every letter in a very, very deep manner, which have been developed by Peter Stokes, our DH professor, who has developed the archetype or DigiPal application, which some of you may know. Our computer vision engineer has now developed a segmenter and a line recognizer, which are also working with noisy images quite well. On the NLP side, we have been collaborating with the Dicta Lab in Jerusalem by Moshe Koppel and with Latisse, Thierry Poirbeau. There is no open annotated corpus for rabbinic Hebrew, so we have tried to bootstrap one. What we did is first use a tagger that was developed for modern Hebrew, apply it on a Vulgate text that has relatively close orthography to modern Hebrew, manually correct a large chunk of it, use this as ground truth for training a new LSTM-based model, which has very high, very low error rate. They calculated 94% for the part of speech. And we are now at about 40K tokens, which represents 55K words, but this should grow exponentially in the next year.
And the last shared, the last project that sort of part of this universe is a project, a text reuse project. So I was actually extraordinarily excited when I saw that a number of the projects here were about text reuse, because I'm just dipping my toes in. I have been working now for a number of years as part of an NEH-DFG grant to do an alignment between the Mishnah and the Tosefta, and this graph is not meant to be entirely intelligible, but there is this complicated relationship between these two corpora that are theoretically contemporaneous. There's lots of verbal overlap, but also lots of different material, and the question is how to model that. So we started with the same procedure that other projects have started with, which is just string matching, finding zones of overlapping text, and use a relatively fast heuristic method to grab those rather than dynamic programming. But what I'd really like to see happen, and what I think would be really interesting, and the University of Maryland gave me a small grant to develop it, is to actually expand that to multiple corpora that are in sort of the same, or multiple, sorry, use my terminology I introduced before, multiple works that are part of the same library. Right, each of which may have, I mean, I'm not making it that complex, we're using one representation of each text, but in theory could include variation as well. And then the question becomes, how do you actually model that? As you can see, I'm still in search of a data model that's not a whole bunch of one-to-one matches, but that's actually a many-to-many, right? And at that point, the goal is to be able to have to be able to look at ranges of shared texts that appear across corpora. So a biblical verse, let's say, that is quoted in 100 different places in 7 different works, or the way in which commentaries on a particular passage. One of the things that commentators do is revise the text. No, the text shouldn't be this, it should be that, right? So look at, you know, the way in which the text gets re-presented over time or in different shared places. And so the question is now how to take this text, how to take the Mishnah and this model of the Mishnah that we're working on with its, and the ability to do these one-to-one comparisons with another work and put it into a real small n network of relationships. I'm using small n in the sense that I'm not speaking as a programmer. I'm speaking as just on the conceptual level. We're talking about these are a whole bunch of intersecting paths that need to be understood further.
And we thank you very much for your attention. We try to talk a little faster to have a little more time for discussion. Hope not too fast.
So, thank you very much. Thank you very much for your presentation. I'm sure there are many questions. I have questions, but maybe I would like to give the... Who have question? No? Oh, yeah.
This is very simple. I'm just wondering if you can say a little bit more about the work you did to develop your front-end interface, and you talked about another team that you were working with or a group that had helped you on that, and I wonder if you could just elaborate on that a little bit.
So so because we're in an XML environment, we're looking for things that, and it's specifically TI environment, we're looking for things that work well with XML, and we're also increasingly needing the use of a database. So we ported our originally, freestanding XML material into into Exist, which is an XML database structure. Right now, the people who developed Exist have a development company as well that does front-end development, and they built a project that is free and open source called TEI Publisher that uses the TEI XML standard, and then what it'll automatically do in a sense is build you a table of contents and give you search capabilities. Plus, one of the things you want with XML is validation, right? So what the TEI people developed was a document called Odd that generates validation and documentation and also sort of interactive error checking, notifications and things like that, right? And they added another piece to it, which I think they call rendition, which is the expected behavior, right? What do you want it to be? And then you can specify whether that's default or not. Right, and by adding that, when you plug it into TEI Publisher, it will automatically know. And they also built a form interface so that you don't have to go into the code. You can say, I want something called P to always look the following. I want something called highlight to always do the following. Right, and then your edition will generate. And I sort of think about it. By the sort of the Pareto rule, right, that it'll cover 80% of your problems 80% of the time, right? And then there's all of the stuff that doesn't work when you do that, right? But what it does do, if you are going to build something more complex than here's my text, I want to show it, right, or I want to print it as a PDF, right, because they have facilities for that as well. If you want to do something more complex than that, that's what you can focus on. You can write the code to show to do the apparatus, right? They've also in some sense been very responsive in the sense that we said we wanted these features. They don't exist in TEI Publisher. Oh, this is an opportunity for us to develop these features because people will use it. Did you want to say?
And the lab we have been collaborating with a lot is DICTA in Jerusalem, led by Moshe Koppel, who is a professor of NLP at Bar-Ilan University. And the other two important, or three important group members are Avi Schmidman, his son. When I first saw him working in the lab, he was 17 years old, this small guy, but already programming like a world champion, working with neural networks. Shaltiel Schmidman and Yael Netzer, and they've been very collaborative with regard to textual alignment and especially with the morphological analysis of Semitic languages, which is complex because, we didn't go into detail here, but you don't write vowels in Arabic or in Hebrew. So it's very agglutinative. So a preposition which is short gets linked to the word directly. If you have the conjunction and, it becomes a part of the token. The article becomes part of the token. If you have a possessive pronoun, it becomes part of the token. If you have a pronoun object for a verb, it becomes part of the token, and so on. So a whole sentence in an Indo-European language can become one single word in a Semitic language. And so it's incredibly morphologically rich. And on the other hand, it's very, very, very polysemic. So you have one form. Certain forms can be interpreted if you don't have it in context. It's 40 different words or resolutions. So if you have a sentence, I think the average in English is 1.7 or something like that. In Semitic languages, I believe it's something like 3. If you have a sentence of 10 words, the amount of variability is incredible. So that's where the LSTM approach really has increased the ratio of success quite considerably compared to previous approaches. And still we needed to bootstrap because the only ground truth that is there is ours. now. There is a very, very nice and very clean data from the Israel Academy of the Hebrew language, but it's not open. So you can interact with the data through a web interface, but it's not open. So you can't use it as a ground truth for training anything or for annotating anything. Yes, and it's a very shallow annotation. So ours is much deeper, taking into account not only the lemma, but also the part of speech and the morphological analysis. And that's where Dicta has been very helpful.
Yeah, I have the microphone anyway. I was really fascinated by the OCR engine that you developed to account for the manuscript. Certainly, you're getting far, far better results. We tried it with medieval manuscripts and ran into all sorts of problems. But I was wondering how your engine accounts for, particularly in its alignment, rubrics, marginalia, and particularly intralinear insertions and deletions. How do you account for those, and if so, how?
So those are the problematic fields. We do not have a lot of rubrics in the manuscripts we had been dealing with, so we focused really on the main text. We have one of our manuscripts on the average has 1 million characters, and we want to get more than 970,000 right, because every 10,000 more is problematic. So if we have 1,000 marginalia, so what? I don't care for them. I care for the main text. That's the main problem. That's where I need to pay assistance or myself sit down and work during the weekend nights. The same for marginalia, as long as we can kill them and don't, so that they don't interfere with the main text. We can deal with marginalia, which are usually also much smaller, in a second way. But as long as we can clean the text and only get the main text, first step is done. So this is now where the segmenter of Ben Kiesling, who has built a whole application called Kraken, which is now quite widely used, and it's open source, and it's Harvard is building something on it, which will Corpus Builder, which will be very useful for, I mean, they have used it in the Sharia source project in order to build huge Arabic corpora. JSTOR will use it. But still, it's built on Acropus, but it has taken into account all the recent developments in document analysis, so moved away from the original neural network specification of Acropus, and improved that quite a bit. And in the recent months, what Ben has been working on is a segmenter, meaning to be able to distinguish background, main foreground, marginal foreground, illuminations and manuscripts, so that you can analyze each of them apart. We are now training those, and then we can see how good they are. The basic concept has been developed by the document analysis team Diva Dia in Fribourg. What we are doing is taking those concepts and putting them into an application that will actually work on our stuff. I always say we are the École Pratique des Hautes Études. I'm very practical, very pragmatic. I need this nice algorithmic stuff to work. I want to use it. I want to have 1,000 manuscripts in 2 years and not just a nice algorithmic publication. So that is where the segmenter, we're now piloting on Papyri with the University of Heidelberg, so that we can align the existing transcriptions of the papyrological corpus, which is huge, with the images on the papyri, in order to start working in a much more computational way on that paleography as well, and have a couple of other projects in the same direction.
I
I have two questions. Oh, you mentioned in your talk the use of crowdsourcing technique, which seems to me very appropriate for your problem, because I suppose that you have many people studying the Mishnah who could give you some comments. But can you say more in depth what are the results and how do you manage exactly with this? And because one of the difficulty common with crowdsourcing is to motivate people. And so is it possible in the context of the Mishnah?
Okay. That project has just started. It's a French-Israeli project of the Foreign Ministry and the Ministry of Sciences on both sides. And we are now creating the application. So we haven't actually started the crowdsourcing process itself. Our partner is the University of Haifa, and that's the only university in Israel which has already a BA in digital humanities and is driving this thrust very much. And our aim is to engage in particular Israeli audience, but also educated Jewish audience for Hebrew text, that is obviously the primary audience for this kind of job. Still, for that project, we are working on not on the Mishnah, we are working on medieval Midrash, which is in a different script, which is more difficult to read for modern people. So it will be more challenging on that side. University of Haifa has a project together with Oxford, Princeton, and I've forgotten another university, I'm sorry, about the scribes of the Geniza. The Geniza is a huge manuscript trove of 300,000 manuscripts from Middle Ages, from Cairo, or Fustat in that time, a trove which is the reason that we know much more about medieval Judaism than we know about medieval Islam on the social history side, because we have all these documents. And they're working there with crowdsourcing to transcribe part of these manuscripts, still with manual means, but with crowdsourcing. So from their experience, we hope to profit also for this project. But the engineer is actually coming to Paris in November, and that's when we will actually start really programming the crowdsourcing interface. We have already spoken to projects in Barcelona which have worked on Spanish archives, but those are archival texts and not literary texts, and there are important differences. So on the one, you can work with word spotting and it's very repetitive. You can do clustering because you always have the same kind of image, while in the literary world, there are different problems.
So I think it's very, very interesting and exciting perspective. I have a second question, but you mentioned the problem of text reuse, that we have many to many, and I had this problem, but it was maybe not so complex as here. And one of the problems is the visualization of this. And do you have some solution? Because
I was watching your presentation yesterday very carefully to see. I mean, I like the idea of what Travis has done, you know, where you have sort of weighted railroad tracks. I mean, it makes sense of the units of text, right? But I've already heard that it doesn't scale particularly well. And at this point, I'm actually less concerned, I should say less concerned, less worried about the visualization than I am about the underlying data structure. Now, how do you get, you know, all of these references, you know, all of these references referring back to sources, but also referring to each other and not going in a circle if the same thing happens to be quoted twice in the same text, so you're going round and round, right? So that's the thing I'm trying to figure out how to work through. And wondering whether, I mean, I had one developer say to me that, you know, your data is small enough, you should still be thinking about a SQL framework and just use a brute force sort of method, but But ideally, you know, we can move to, you know, several billion words, right? And then what happens? And I don't know, again, this is one of these places where I'm simply learning as I go, so I don't have an answer to that. Since I am holding the microphone, though, I'm going to, one of the things Daniel said reminded me of one of my pet hobby horses that I'm surprised I didn't mention in terms of the significance of the work that we're doing on the Mishnah in particular. And that is because our manuscripts are all medieval, right, and a lot of them are in fragmentary form from the Cairo Geniza. In a sense, one of the payoffs in terms of social, cultural, literary history is not about the Jews or Palestine in late antiquity, but in many ways about the medieval book, right? How did it, how did one particularly privileged text circulate in 1,000 different copies, you know, most, you know, in 7 or 8 different regional hands in formats that range from very formal, deluxe editions to something that's clearly written in somebody's cursive, right? And that, it seems to me, to be one of the big payoffs. And one of the ways that we've tried to go back to that interoperability or issue, that one of the things we've tried to do is not foreclose what you can do with the data based on our interests, but that, in fact, you may actually be interested in what happens when you're only looking in at German hands from the 15th century, right? And to actually sort of frame the project so that it's not our historians' interest that's driving it, but other things as well.